Hey, Alyssa Nicole.
Hey, Samantha, who shall not be middle named.
Are you ready to get schooled?
I am ready to get schooled, and I'm grateful because my brain is like not fully on today. So I'm glad that you're going to teach me today. Stuck at the office or traffic jam. Time to take it easy with Alyssa and Sam. Is that show you know? A pro.
So I was talking to Matthew. I don't know why my eyes are watering now.
Oh.
I know.
Now she's the emotional one.
The tables have turned.
How the turntables.
Exactly. I was talking to Matthew, my husband, life partner, etc.
Love of my life.
Yeah. And I was talking about how when we do guest episodes, sometimes like feedback that we get is that we haven't talked enough, which usually we're just like, I mean, we're just listening to this guest that has graciously come onto the podcast.
Yeah. Well, and they know better.
Exactly. Typically speaking, they're more intelligent than, I'm going to say, me and not both of us because, you know.
And that's, well, that's the thing, though. They're experts in their field.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're it's not that they're more intelligent overall. They're just, they've dedicated their life to that area of study.
And that's what they're here for. So, yeah. But that is some feedback that we sometimes get. I was talking about that feedback and then also how sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish we could have expanded on that topic, but a lot of the times as well, like, our guests obviously have, you know, lives outside of the podcast, which we do not. So I was like, there's sometimes things that I want to like expand on or like talk more about or ask more questions about, and he was like, well, why don't you do a podcast doing exactly that, like expanding on things that were in the guest episode. So that's what we're doing. It's gonna be great. Okay, I realize that the premise doesn't sound that interesting, but it's great.
I'm interested.
Thank you.
Don't put yourself down like that. It was a good idea.
Well, it wasn't my idea, so really.
Don't put Matt down like that.
Yeah, fuck that guy. So, let's get into it.
Okay. Just in case they missed the last episode, maybe Sure. Let's talk about, like, what the last episode was.
So, the last episode, I am going to go through, like, note by note of, like, what we brought up. The last episode we had on Dr. Melanie Badali, and she is an expert in anxiety and phobias and stuff like that. She's a psychologist. She has over 20 years of experience. So that's what she was talking about. And through that conversation, a few different things came up that I just wanted to like look into more.
Yeah.
So I had mentioned briefly about women receiving non-judgmental care and how that led to better outcomes in terms of like labor and birth. So I wanted to expand on that just a touch. So this is a Cochrane report. There was 26 studies involving more than 15,000 women from 17 countries. And so this was just, they were trying to look at women that received continuous support. So this is support throughout the entire like labor and birth. So be it from like a doula or midwife or hospital staff or like a family friend, whatever. And what they found in most of these cases is that women who received continuous labor support were more likely to give birth spontaneously, meaning giving birth vaginally with no forceps, cesarean, or like vacuum suctioning. And in addition, that women may be less likely to use pain medications and may be more likely to be satisfied and have shorter labors as well. And so on average, it was like 45 to an hour less for labor. And then postpartum depression could also be lower in women who are supported in labor. But they said that they couldn't be sure of this due to the studies being difficult to compare, like, you know, people living in different areas and settings and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I feel like it would be hard to have like a controlled study of I mean, what do you deem as like support, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then it said the babies of women who received continuous support may be less likely to have low 5-minute Apgar scores, which is the score used when babies' health and well-being are assessed at birth and shortly afterwards.
Or which, sorry?
It's the score used when babies' health and well-being are assessed at birth and shortly afterwards.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. So anyways, that's just kind of interesting. I just wanted to expand on that a little bit. You, I think, Alyssa, brought up East Hastings.
Yes.
So East Hastings, or Downtown East Side, is a neighborhood in Vancouver, for those of you that don't know, Vancouver, Canada. And this is an area that's really widely known for addiction issues, homelessness, mental illness issues as well. So I just wanted to give some facts about that. This is mostly from the Wikipedia page, okay? The population of the downtown east side is about 7,000 people. Before the 1980s, the downtown east side was kind of like the hub of the city, so political, cultural, and retail center of the city. And then that area experienced a rapid decline following an influx of hard drugs, release of mentally ill individuals, which was due to psychiatric hospitals reducing the number of patient days of care by about 65%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so many of the deinstitutionalized people moved to the downtown east side between this time, like 1985, 1999, because they were seeking low-cost housing. But without adequate support and treatment, many of them became addicted to drugs, which were just really readily available in that area.
I mean, and I would argue that, you know, drugs are pretty readily available if it's something that you even remotely are looking for. Which oftentimes, because of like self-medication, if you're not being cared for at, you know, the proper venues, could be something to help you escape.
Well, and it's crazy too, because they reference specifically Riverview Hospital, which is the one right by that movie theater that we go to. So it's like that abandoned hospital. You would have driven past it like a bunch of times. But that hospital also is used in like a ton of movies and stuff like that. And it's been shut down since 2006, I want to say. Maybe later even. But yeah, there was like a ton of abuse and stuff like that happening there as well.
Sorry, I want to say as well, when I said help you escape, I'm not advocating, obviously, for drug use to deal with mental illness. I'm just saying why it may be that somebody
for sure
would use it for escapism.
So release of mentally ill individuals, policies pushing prostitution and drug-related activity out of nearby areas, and then the cessation of federally funded social housing. That was also like what contributed to the decline of that area. And then by 1997, there was an HIV epidemic, HIV and drug overdose epidemic, which led to the declaration of a public health emergency. At that time, the rate of infection was worse than anywhere else in the world outside of sub-Saharan Africa for HIV.
Oh, wow.
I know. Is that not, because it's such a small area with like really such a small population.
Yeah.
But that was how bad it was. And so that led to the creation of North America's first legal safe injection site in 2003. And the rates of HIV infection dropped from 8.1 cases out of 100 people in 1997 to 0.37 cases out of 100 people in 2011.
It's like very obviously statistically successful.
And I'm going to get in.
Oh, she's got a whole page of notes.
I'm going to get into that.
I'm really sorry. I'm still in my yoga clothes from my yoga teacher training, but I'm like burning up like the Jonas Brothers.
Let it out. Downtown Eastside also has a high population of Indigenous Canadians who are disproportionately affected by the neighborhood's social problems. It also has one of the highest police-related death rates in Canada. It's tied with another place in Alberta, I believe.
Wild.
So, I know. And overwhelmingly, people killed are either in mental distress, so about 64%, and or have discernible mental health or substance abuse issues, which is 75.8% of victims.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of sad. It's a little bit of like a rough area in general, and they just have a lot of different problems going on. Also, this is just a little bit of a historical thing. Between 1980 and 2002, more than 60 women went missing from the downtown east side, most of whom were sex workers. And then Robert Picton, who is a Canadian serial killer, was charged with the murder of 26 of those women.
Yeah, we studied one woman's particular case in women's studies when I was in college.
With Robert Picton?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was her story. I can't remember the book now.
So wait. She got out or she was murdered?
No, she was murdered.
Oh, okay.
I think it was her sister that wrote the book, I want to say, but now I can't. It was 10 years ago that I was in college.
It was quite a horrific story if you guys like care to like look into it more.
Yeah. But it's true. And I think if I recall correctly as well in the book, they were saying that because it was, you know, sex workers and often Indigenous sex workers that were going missing, you know, the air quotes interest was low to try and help find them. And some people had argued that, you know, there's questionable behaviors, right? So you could go off the radar for a couple of days and then come back, and that's was their argument, is that, oh, they'll turn back up. But yeah. I mean, you have to discern at some point that this is not
a missing person from like a,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to talk more about, the legal injection site. So this is, in Vancouver, it's called Insite. If you want to look it up, INSITE. And so again, North America's first legal injection site. This is like a really controversial thing, usually, to people outside of Vancouver.
I know, that's what's funny too. Sorry to interrupt you. When people say it's controversial, I'm like, why? Because, like, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? My circle doesn't feel like it's controversial.
Yeah.
But outside of Vancouver, you're absolutely right. It is quite controversial.
Well, and I think because you can see the positive effects of it, and it's so clear to see, really, when you look into it. But I think that it really comes down to stigma. There was a political someone, I can't remember who it was exactly, but he said that it was like an abomination. And so there has been continual lobbying to try and get Insite shut down. And Insite actually exists under an exemption of the like Controlled Substances Act of Canada. And it was supposed to be shut down. Like, it was supposed to be like a preliminary thing, just for a while. And then it was supposed to get shut down. And then they were like, eh, we'll leave it for a little bit longer. We'll leave it for a little bit longer. And then it's just stayed ever since.
Can you test your drugs there as well?
Let me tell you.
Sorry.
So Insite is a legal injection site, but it's also, they supply clean needles, sterile cookers, filters, water, and tourniquets. They also have a checking service, so clients can check drugs for fentanyl or carfentanil. And then they have medical staff present to provide addiction treatment, mental health assistance, and first aid. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Insite actually has, right above Insite, they have Onsite, which is, I think it's actually kind of treated almost like, not like a halfway house, but like it's like people can stay there overnight and stuff like that if they want addiction treatment and stuff. So if they are there and they want help, they can just like literally go right upstairs. So it's a really, really good system in that way. And then also kind of like the process, from what I understand, is like you would go into the injection room, inject, there's like medical staff on site, obviously, and then you can go into a room after that where you can kind of like sit and wait it out. They recorded over 175,000 visits from 7,301 unique users in 2017. There was 2,100 overdoses that occurred that year with no fatalities due to medical intervention. And Health Canada only provides Insite with $500,000 a year to operate the site, which I'm not sure if that seems like a lot of funding.
That seems like very little funding to me, yeah.
Well, when you think about the fact, I mean, obviously this is, I think it's completely run by volunteers. I could be wrong. But like with the amount of visitors that they have, the amount of supplies that they're, you know, supplying, like it just seems like such a small amount. Like really, when you compare that to the alternative, which is either not helping these people, leading to obviously, like we mentioned, like high rates of infectious diseases,
overdose,
death,
yeah,
or trying to like forcibly rehabilitate people or not forcibly, you know, just like in a cost wise, which like obviously that's not the issue at hand, like, but if we're looking at this from like a purely like political financial right. aspect, it's such an affordable and effective option. And so that's why it's so bizarre to me that it is controversial, because why?
Yeah, well, and to give that like even some context, the 500,000, well, this just came to me just now. I'm gonna say the other one in a second. What was that art installation under the bridge? How much did that cost? Oh, God,
$100,000.
Okay,
so the public transit, yeah.
So $100,000 for, I thought it was more.
Editing Alyssa here, sorry to interrupt. The art installation that I'm speaking of here is actually a $4.8 million chandelier that was installed under Vancouver's Granville Bridge. $4.8 million. Okay, thank you.
Just a moment to thank today's sponsor, which is Native Deodorant.
Native deodorant is filled with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil for its antimicrobial properties, shea butter for moisturizing, and tapioca starch to absorb wetness.
They have so many tasty scents.
Tasty scents.
Dude, the pumpkin spice latte.
I know, you won't let it go. She's fall fresh.
I am fall fresh. Like, honestly, when I'm working out, I swear to goodness.
I had that scent beside my computer the other day, and I was smelling it because it reminded me. We made these, like, pumpkin spice cookies, and it reminded me of that, so I was smelling it while I was working. Native is formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc, which can clog your sweat glands and keep you from sweating, which we don't want.
No, sweating's good for you.
Yeah, man. Sweat it out.
We just don't necessarily want to, like...
I don't want that stank.
No, I want to stink good.
I want to stink good.
And I stink good right now.
It's vegan and never tested on animals, and there's no risk to try because Native offers free shipping and 30-day returns and exchanges within the U.S. Listen to their fall seasonal flavors.
Oof.
Okay. Coconut milk and turmeric, buttercream and French vanilla.
Yeah.
Damn. Okay. All of these are going to have a smell and tasty. Blood orange and clove.
Blood orange is actually such like a fall slash winter scent.
It really is.
Yeah.
Mixed with that clove though.
Yeah.
Mm.
That would smell. Ooh, what if you mix the pumpkin spice one with the clove?
You blended
one?
It? Mm. Or like one under each arm so then people can be like, what's.
Yeah. She's so unique.
Yeah.
You know how like quirky. You blend all your foundations together?
Yes, exactly.
Do the same with deodorant.
Yeah. And then also rosemary and lemon zest.
Aww.
An herbaceous scent.
Yeah.
Love it. Native is also now offering plastic-free packaging, which is phenomenal. We love to see it, and it's made from 100% paperboard. So if you guys would like to try Native deodorant, you can get 20% off your first purchase by visiting nativedeo.com/approachable20 and use code approachable20 during checkout.
That's nativedeo.com/approachable20 to get 20% off your first order with Native.
Thank you so much, Native.
For a chandelier, was it? Underneath a bridge?
Let me look it up.
Yeah, because I agree. I think that art is important. And, you know, especially for tourism and stuff like that. But if you're trying to say apples to apples, like what's more important, like a piece of art or human life? I don't know. That's up to you to decide, I guess. But I'm doing a project for my yoga teacher training as well on yoga therapy and how it can help in recovery from addiction. And I was researching and... the funding for the DEA is over $2 billion annually. So when you think about, and I know that that's the US, of course, and not Canada, but when you think about charging people for drug crimes and stuff like that, and oftentimes that's on like a larger scale when the DEA is involved and stuff, but when Richard Nixon said like drugs are public enemy number one, it's like, but are they?
Yeah.
Drugs are an object. Okay, drugs are basically inherently unchanging. You know, you can modify the chemical structure, but they're unchanging. They're not going to change their nature because you tell them to.
Yeah.
So what can we change? We can change the way that people see drugs or seek out drugs. And then for me, that's finding the underlying reason that drugs could be a shiny, air quotes, shiny object for these people. And that underlying reason is like a myriad of reasons, of course. But a big one is mental health.
Yeah.
And so whilst people are in the throes of addiction, which is a disease of the brain, right? Nobody came out and said that, things that cause, well, that's not a good one to make, but I was thinking about this in the car about how, you know, cancer is a disease. And obviously my dad passed away from cancer. So that's why I kind of leapt to that one. You know, he wasn't looked at with stigma in that way, right?
What did you do to cause your cancer kind of thing?
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, there are obviously cancer-causing products and stuff like that that we can avoid and stuff, but no, I don't feel like anyway, anyone's looking at a cancer patient being like, well, why did you eat peanut butter? You know what I mean? So for me, I feel like the disconnect there is stigma.
Yeah.
And while people are in the throes of addiction, which like I said, is a disease, let's try to make that process not more comfortable, but let's get you through that process.
Well, just so have more support around it and resources. Well,
but so that you can get through it, so that you don't unfortunately end your life.
Yeah.
Right? Like not even on purpose, right, with overdose and stuff like that, and especially the opioid crisis, which is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And is a crisis that we're fighting currently.
I got facts on that.
She's here.
Yeah. But I also wanted to mention, because I just thought that this was an uplifting fact, 95% of the clients of Insight say that they find the staff respectful and trustworthy. And I just thought that that was pleasant, because I do think that, you know, beyond all of these other problems, I think that a lot of people struggling with both mental illness and substance abuse issues are treated as like less than human. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just like a really horrific, you know, thing that we do as a society to people that really just they need help.
Yeah. I think that as humans, we fear what we can't predict, right? Like, we like to anticipate how someone is going to react with us and take that kind of, like, experience and go into it like that. And oftentimes, just the nature of using drugs, people can be unpredictable. And I think that that actually might be a part of where that stems from. Mm. Just trying to, you know, like, understand the sort of stigma, I guess, like, why people might be treating, you know, people struggling with substance abuse and addiction less than. I think that truly, because I do see humanity in so many people, like I see so much good even in people that I don't agree with, right? And so I want to try to understand why they feel that way, because if we understand that, maybe we can like flip the script.
Yeah.
And say, okay, maybe you are worried that this person will do something unpredictable, but you can still then see their humanity.
Yeah. Well, and I also think too that there's kind of this like incorrect belief that drug addicts are like exclusively people who are like homeless and like down on their luck and whatever, and like there's tons and tons and tons of like functioning people with like substance abuse issues that are working and they have families and they seem like, you know, like quote, like productive, like members of society. And so I think, you know, there's the stigma of like, why should I have to pay for somebody who's not working? And, you know, they're just doing whatever, they're like throwing their life away and stuff like that. But it's like, but that's not everybody that's dealing mm-hmm. with addiction. And also, it just comes down to like basic humanity. Like that shouldn't be what it's about, because there was likely something that led that person to get there, you know?
Exactly.
And I also wanted to mention, I didn't write down notes about it, so don't quote me directly, but the community of the Downtown East Side has been continually kind of, like, people have tried to, like, clean up the area and, like, sort of, like, push those people out of that area.
Push them to where?
Exactly. and the community, not only, like, of homeless people, but people that actually, like, live in the area, in houses, have kind of like fought back against that, because it's such a tight-knit community. Mm-hmm. And the community in general has also advocated for themselves to like open up parks and like clean up different areas. Do you know Crab Park?
No.
Okay, so that's like right by where I used to live. If you walk right down the street at like the end of Main Street kind of thing, there's a park right there that's like along the beach, and they actually advocated for that park to be opened. And so There's just a bunch of things that they've done, like, as a community to sort of, like, clean up the area themselves and reopen different centers and stuff like that. So, you know, I think it's just, I don't know, it's just always comes back to that stigma. But you mentioned the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So Canada, but also the U.S., is currently experiencing an opioid crisis and fentanyl specifically as well. So since 2016, there's been more than 9,000 opioid-related deaths in Canada. And Canadians aged 15 to 24 are the fastest growing population requiring hospital care from opioid overdoses. Fentanyl is an opioid that can't be seen, tasted, or smelled. And so it's become more and more common for it to be, for like street drugs to be laced with fentanyl. And a few grains of salt worth can be enough to kill you. So that's been a huge issue. Death and hospitalization rates were highest in BC, Alberta, and then Yukon and Northwest Territories within Canada.
That's surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that per capita, do you know, or just numbers?
Don't know.
Because I feel like, wow, that's so interesting.
But I think, again, you know, areas with high indigenous populations as well are likely to be more affected because those communities are more affected by substance abuse.
Right.
At least within Canada. I'm not sure what the statistics are like.
Well, and I wonder if they would receive poorer quality of care.
I'm sure.
Therefore relating to more deaths.
Yeah, for sure.
Something to the reason, well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a drug supplier, but the reasons that I've heard.
A drug supplier.
I'm not a drug dealer. The reasons I've heard that they are cutting things like heroin with fentanyl is because it takes so much less
to get you high.
To get you high. And so mm-hmm. it's cheaper for yeah. for the supplier. And also with COVID, it's really slowed, which is, this is what's so interesting to me about like the war on drugs. Sorry, I know I'm going back to that again, but
hit it.
It's slowed the import of drugs into the country.
Oh, really?
Yeah, how are they going to get it through? Like, there's so much, you know, it's a lot harder for, you know, they're losing work too, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's still drug addicts, obviously. There's still people with substance abuse issues, even through this pandemic, of course. And so people are going to continue to use, and suppliers are going to have to come up with more, quote, again, creative ways to continue their product, right? Yeah. And, you know, if there's not a supply of, I don't want to say clean drugs because very, very, very few yeah. are obviously clean. But if there's not a supply coming from where they might normally come from, it's going to be supplied somehow and worse or stepped on, as yeah. they would say, you know, like mixed and laced with different things. And it's really, really gotten bad. And there's even like signs around Vancouver and the greater Vancouver area that say, your drugs are not clean. Like the actual city, you know, is putting up,
you're like, let's not mess around anymore.
Well, but that, and I actually did love that when I saw that. It was a huge billboard going into New Westminster, and I saw it, and I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was basically like, please be careful, like the drugs are not clean. Mm-hmm. And I would so much rather drive into a city and see that than know that we're trying to hide,
yeah,
you know, this really horrible thing that could kill you. And like you said, it's not, there's no poster child, yeah. and there's no poster adult or whatever for addiction or using drugs. There's people who have used cocaine for the first time, you know, young teens for the first time, and overdosed because that was laced mm-hmm. with an opioid, right? And so I don't know. I don't feel like I even need to make that comparison, but I do feel the need because for some reason we care more, you know, about the family who lost their child
yeah.
or, you know, again, air quotes, upstanding citizen yeah. than if, you know, the, you know, people living on the downtown east side or whatever.
Yeah, well, exactly. Someone that people view as having, like, potential within exactly. society kind of thing.
Which everyone has potential.
Exactly, yeah. And I also, throughout, like, all of this, because I did, like, we ended up kind of, like, bringing up drugs and rehab and stuff like that quite a few times. And so I was surprised by how little there is in the way of, like, information, but also resources when I was trying to look it up. There's a lot of people talking about the opioid crisis, but there's not a lot of like statistics around it, I found. So I'm just not sure if I'm like a bad researcher or what, but I spent a lot of time on it and I wasn't able to find like a ton of statistics about it, which was just surprising because it is obviously, you know, impacting our society in a big way. And I wanted to also just mention that the opioid crisis includes both prescription and illegal opiates. So. Yeah. You know, that's like a different side to it as well, because again, going back to that stigma of the belief that like, and this also lends to people not getting help because they feel like, well, I have a job, I'm taking prescription opiates, I'm fine, you know, like, but you can be just as deep into substance abuse as somebody who's homeless and looks more traditionally like a drug addict, you know?
Right.
So I think that's an important one to mention.
There's actually, sorry, I came in around
that's
you.
Okay.
There's a couple celebrities who have had some serious, serious substance abuse issues, and they took prescription painkillers or whatever, and you might think, oh, well, I'm not going to buy it from a drug addict or whatever. I'm just abusing this prescription, or yeah. I've managed to get my doctor to prescribe this, or whatever it might be. That, yeah, like you said, doesn't seem as much like an issue, but
yeah. That also, a few people were asking, we referenced a podcast like very, very quickly. Actually, Dr. Badali referenced a podcast talking about a celebrity who had recently had a relapse. And there was a few of you guys asking what podcast that was. So that was Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, and it was the episode called Day 7. So Dax Shepard is a celebrity who had been kind of like famously sober for 16 years. And he talks about that whole journey and relapsing actually a couple times over that time. And just recently took a new sober date, basically. So it's a really, really great episode. I thought it was really interesting to hear from his perspective, and to just, he was just like very forthcoming, and obviously it would be very difficult because he is a celebrity, and you know, right. like there's just so much attached to that. So it was a great episode, and I definitely recommend checking it out. I also was, I'm curious to know, I don't have the answer for this, but when you were talking about like checking drugs and stuff like that and drugs not being clean, and with Insight having a checking service, I'm curious to know, like, are people less likely to actually use drugs if they do a checking service and find out that it is laced, or does that just more so help the medical staff, I wonder?
So I can't speak to Insight.
Yeah.
But I do know... I'm thinking back to that comment that was like, was Alyssa the mob wife? I do know from my past that if there were drug site checkings available at festivals or whatever it might be, the general festival goers would throw out their drugs wow. if they were unsafe.
I'm surprised.
You know what? I'm not surprised by that, because we don't want to take drugs that we think are going to kill us. Yeah. I think that that's, again, like not stigma on your part, but I think like stigma in the general population that it's just like these.
Like people who are so flippant.
Savages or whatever that just, you know, they'll take whatever they can get. And I think that, you know, sometimes it can get to a place where, you know, there's very little like room for reasoning in the brain at mm-hmm. that point, for sure. I can see that. And I've definitely been in phases of my life where I haven't had a whole lot of reasoning going on in my brain. But absolutely, there's a lot of people who, you know, would rather choose to seek out again.
Yeah.
You know, a safer alternative if they find out that their drug, because you know, at these festivals and stuff like that, generally speaking, it's recreational drug use, which is still very serious, because oftentimes, you know, it gets
can be dangerous too.
Yeah, it gets out of hand. And I don't want to say out of hand as if like recreational drug use isn't dangerous too. But again, I'm also not like super judgmental. So anyway, just like it's, there's a lot like going on. But where was I going with that now?
You were talking about people like throwing out drugs that are not, and you were saying like that at these,
right. Sorry. So these recreational drug users, they're taking it to have a good time. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? They're not taking it, because they are oftentimes like, because they're going through withdrawal or something like that, you yeah. know? And so, I don't advocate outwardly. I advocate very like inwardly and within my circle, for drug testing, absolutely. I could advocate outwardly, actually, and I will do that. I just need to find the avenues. I just hadn't really thought about doing that.
Yeah. Interesting. You had also brought up, Alyssa, waiting times for rehab and mm-hmm. how that could potentially impact people's likelihood of getting treatment. So in 2016 in the U.S., 21 million people approximately aged 12 and up needed substance abuse treatment. Only about 3.8 million got treatment, so that's about 18%, which actually was higher than I was expecting.
Right.
Also, about 240 million people globally consume alcohol problematically, and there's about 15 million people that use injection drugs, which I think is
globally?
Like, yeah, apparently. Which I think is like important to note, because I think that, and I think we've talked about this in the podcast before, but we've certainly talked about it privately, but I think that alcohol abuse specifically is very much so swept under the rug, mm-hmm. because it is like a much more widespread problem, and it's just so common for people to be using alcohol problematically, and yet it's treated as if it's like very socially acceptable, and you know, again, like it's not like we're like looking down on anyone using alcohol. Obviously we're both sober here. But you know, like it's kind of crazy like how casual we are about alcohol consumption.
Well, and to those people again who, you know, question specifically me, I feel like they question me often if I'm judgmental, or I sound judgmental of other people drinking, I guess I would just ask you to maybe take a look at like why you feel that way. Because I'm not judgmental of people who drink alcohol. I'm concerned for certain people for sure, yeah. in my life who drink alcohol. But I know that when I even had like a sneaking suspicion that I had alcohol use disorder or like a problem with alcohol or whatever, when people were sober and I just knew that they were sober, I felt like that was a judgment. Mm. And there was a reason for that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that you think I'm judgmental and therefore you have an issue.
Yeah.
But I think it's just worthwhile looking into if maybe you're receiving judgment from anyone else or you're judging yourself perhaps or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what that is. But I mean, all I can say is that I'm not judgmental.
Yeah. For sure. So I just wanted to kind of get into those barriers surrounding people potentially getting treatment or not getting treatment. So one abstract that I was looking up cited that 28.6% of their participants would not seek treatment because they would have to be on a waiting list. Another one cited 53.8% of their participants emphasizing that wait times were a significant barrier. And in that same abstract, a lot of those people mentioned that there's not only the first waiting period, calling for an assessment before and then actually receiving the assessment, the time between those two things, but then a second barrier, which is, you know, the waiting period between after you're assessed but before treatment. And so both of which can cause kind of, you know, people dropping out before they've even gotten into treatment. I tried to call a few rehabs and no one would answer my questions.
Well, I'm really interested. You texted me that before this episode. I'm really interested how those conversations went and why you think they wouldn't answer your questions.
So I don't know, but, one of the first ones that I called, I said, I just was like, what's your typical wait time for treatment? And he was like, well, it depends. I mean, it could be based on like a number of things, like your funding structure. And I was like, okay. And then he was like, but why? And I was like, I'm just doing general research. And he was like, are you wanting to be admitted? And I was like, I'm just doing general research. And he was like, I can't answer that question. And I was like, okay.
But that is so frustrating to me.
I know.
Because for so many reasons. Yeah. But what if I was a concerned partner, parent, mm-hmm. friend, and I wanted to have all of my ducks in a row before I went to my loved one
to approach them about
it. To approach them or offer, you know, help or something like that, and you're not willing to give me information because you're trying to cover your ass, that's immediately where my brain goes. And maybe that's cynicism, but
yeah,
to me that's what it, you know, are you worried that you're a journalist or a reporter or, you know, whatever.
But also, like, I mean, if you were somebody struggling with substance abuse, I agree with you that, like, you know, a lot of the times, and I can relate to this with going to therapy for depression. For me, it was like such a spur of the moment thing. I was like, okay, I recognize I need to go. I'm not like putting it off anymore. I'm not telling myself I'm fine and I need to go. So if I had called someone and they wouldn't answer my questions, wouldn't tell me how long it would be before I could get an appointment, wouldn't tell me how much it was going to cost, like stuff like that, I would be like, never mind. And in one of those abstracts as well, there were a few participants that mentioned that if they felt like they were receiving judgmental care or they felt like the answers to their questions were inadequate in their assessment, that would be a barrier for them too, for pursuing treatment. So that first place that I called, he said that funding structure was a potential thing that could impact wait times, and then he wouldn't answer any questions further. Another place that I called said that they couldn't answer that question. And then a third place that I called said that it would be dependent on a number of factors. And the only factor that they cited was whether or not you were male or female. So some rehabilitation centers separate men from women. And so that was actually the rehab center that Matt went to, my husband. That rehabilitation center basically said, like, so, you know, we might not have space for you if you call in right now and you're female, because we just had 3 male patients leave. So we don't have beds for...
I see.
Yeah. So that was like what they had kind of cited. And then they said that they couldn't answer beyond that. So, but they were the most helpful out of anyone. So there's like a few barriers that kind of go into rehab based on my research, financial being one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's also kind of a disparity between publicly funded rehabilitation centers versus private, which, you know, financially speaking is drastically different. Waiting period, required sobriety pending treatment, which causes a lot of people to not pursue treatment overall.
No kidding.
Yeah, so there's certain rehabilitations that will require you to be sober for whatever amount of time.
If I could get sober on my own, believe me, I wouldn't be going to rehab.
Well, and then that's the other issue, is that there's some people that, like, that's enough to make them not pursue treatment further. And then there's other people that actually are able to get sober during that time, but that lends to them believing that they don't need treatment.
Right.
Which also lends to higher rates of relapse, because they weren't in treatment for,
right.
Well, they weren't in treatment. And then, inaccessibility to info is one that I wrote down, because I felt like even trying to find, government subsidized rehab centers, I felt that was like tricky to track down.
Mm-hmm.
When I was calling private centers, they wouldn't answer my questions. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that as well. If things are difficult to do, already you've knocked out tons of people who are like going to be like, fuck it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And especially people that need help in dire situations, because, you know, they need help now. Mm-hmm. They don't need help 5 weeks from now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and especially people who don't have others advocating for them.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, in my life, I've been really grateful to see people who have struggled with addiction and their family is able to kind of like hold them up and do that kind of like work for them, because they're just not mentally or emotionally capable to do that kind of calling around, excuse me, or filling out of forms or jumping through hoops. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it just kills me that there is so much of that jumping through hoops for people who might not be able to even understand.
Yeah.
Right? Even for myself, like trying to jump through hoops of getting car insurance and stuff like that, that's already a lot for me, and I'm sober right now, so yeah. I'm thinking clearly. And yeah, it really makes me sad. And for the wait times especially, that is something that I really wholeheartedly believe, especially with government funded. I, again, am grateful that we have programs where your treatment can be funded, and detox centers as well, which is huge, because in certain cases, especially with alcohol dependency and perhaps like opioid withdrawal and stuff like that, is a good resource. But the waiting to get there.
Yeah, exactly.
And the requirements, and then, you know, the possibility of lost paperwork and stuff. And I know that these humans behind the resources are doing their very best, but I think that the structure or the funding or, you know, or
yeah,
you know, I think that what, like, such a letdown, right? Like, when I see people who are quite, you know, so seriously struggling in themselves with substance abuse, addiction, mental health, you know?
Yeah.
I think, like, wow, we failed you.
Well, and then we're also treating those people as if, like, less than, and why don't you get a job, and why don't you blah, blah, blah. But it's like, but there's no resources, or there's very little accessibility in the way of resources for people to be able to help themselves anyways. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you're leaving, like, basically no option for these people, then what are you kind of expecting, you know?
Right.
And I wanted to talk about different types of rehabilitation. So the short-term rehabilitation, typically like 28 to 30 days, which would be inpatient, is typically cheaper or sometimes like government subsidized, but statistically not as effective in many cases, especially for severe addictions. Outpatient rehabilitation, which has a higher dropout rate than inpatient, it's best for low risk, people who are at low risk of relapse, or those who don't need medication management, which takes out like a huge group of people as well. And then it's also not ideal for people in acute withdrawal or those who have unstable health conditions. And then there's long-term inpatient treatment, which is the most expensive, typically tricky for those with jobs, because again, going back to the stigma, people thinking that it's like only homeless people addicted to drugs, there's people with families and jobs and whatever. And so long-term inpatient therapy is, you know, you can be gone for usually over 3 months. Mm-hmm. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse states that any program lasting less than 90 days lacks efficacy, and longer stays typically result in better outcomes, including better employment outcomes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I think it's just such a tricky and like sad situation because there isn't enough resources, and the resources that are a little bit more readily available, like outpatient and short-term inpatient treatments, are not as effective.
Yeah. Well, and for context, private rehabs can vary from $15,000 to $30,000 per program. And that's not, you know, that's not the celebrity, you know, bougie sort of situation. That's just quite literally what it costs.
Yeah.
For private.
Which, I mean, is unrealistic for most people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. So that's sad. You had asked Dr. Badali whether or not phobias are regional.
Mm, yes.
I had a hard time finding any evidence around that, any research around that, rather, I should say. But there was... from what I understand, more cultural rather than regional.
Okay.
So one of the things that came up through my research was in Japan, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of this without a doubt because I don't speak Japanese, but it's called Taijin Kyofushu, TKS, okay? Which is a fear of interpersonal relationships characterized by an intense fear that their body is embarrassing to others. Oh. So most Western social phobias focus on the fear of embarrassing yourself, whereas TKS is being afraid of embarrassing others with your presence. So you don't want to offend people with like bodily functions, appearances, including your face, actions, how you look, or odor.
Huh.
And so in Western culture, we're a lot more like individualistic. Kind of like all about me, you know?
Right.
Whereas Japanese culture is more about being like collectivist. So is this going to embarrass my family?
Right.
Stuff like that, which I thought was kind of interesting. And there was another abstract that I was looking up as well that they interviewed people from like all over the world and on different things. Like how scared are you of civil war? How scared are you of genetically modified foods? How scared are you of... whatever, like all these different things. And it was bizarre how much of a difference there was between countries for all of these different things. But of course, like that makes perfect sense. Like there's going to be certain areas of the world that are much more afraid of genetically modified foods just because maybe that's not as much a part of their culture as it is in like America, let's say.
Right.
And same thing with like nuclear war and stuff. Like countries that have been affected more by nuclear war are going to be more... afraid of that than like Sweden.
Yeah.
And actually a lot of Scandinavian countries I noticed they don't got a lot of fears going on. They're pretty like, yeah, everything's fine.
Do you know that this is completely off topic.
Go ahead.
I learned today that Scandinavian countries do a lot of studies on how heat affects the body, which is interesting.
Oh, really?
It's not particularly warm in Scandinavia at all.
So not heat, not lack thereof.
No. but like how heat affects the body in general, like the circulatory system and
why are they curious? Because they're like, we're dying over here.
No, I don't know why they're curious. I just know that there's a lot of benefits to heat.
Yeah, I like being warm.
Yeah, like specifically for like short amounts of times that you can sweat and shit like that, but that's like a whole other thing. But I was interested that they were the ones like that all like a lot of these studies were coming up.
They're the one championing.
Yeah, they're like, we feel like shit.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I'm sure they don't.
But I do notice a huge difference between like doing yoga in like a cold room or like a room temp room rather than a hot room.
Yeah,
huge difference.
I do too. And when I had studied it, very like briefly before, like years ago, I came up with that there was no research that it was better for you or worse really? For you. Yep. Which is incorrect because now I'm in yoga teacher training and there's the slide was all of the things that it benefits for, and then the next slide were all of the studies. Like it was like number one, this, and then the next slide was the study for that, so that you can research it on your own. But yeah, there's like a myriad of reasons that it's good for you.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like 100% necessary in your life, I guess, but...
a nice addition.
Yeah, definitely benefits.
Yeah.
I will say.
I will say, throughout trying to research like a broad range of topics here, it's incredibly hard to find reliable sources. I find...
Yeah?
I do think so, yeah. I find it hard to find, especially with, like, trying to research about, like, the regional
right
things.
Yeah.
Very slim pickings out there. And, yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's interesting. And even with, like, the drugs thing, again, like, it's just was so bizarre to me how hard it was to find even, like, rehabilitation centers and stuff.
Well, and even, like, that's the thing, though, is, like, even these statistics, like, when you said 15 million intravenous drug users, I was shocked because I felt like that was low.
Oh, for sure.
But that's the thing is, like, even with statistics, there's absolutely people who just wouldn't be a part
exactly
of the census.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's the same with when I was researching how many people that struggle with substance abuse also struggle with mental illness. It was 45%, and I was like, I feel like that's so much higher, and that because of the stigma, it creates ignorance, and by ignorance I mean like the lack of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Around it, and so you might just not know.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that number is higher, and maybe that's just me, like, putting my bias onto it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But so even if you get your results from, like, a
reputable source,
it's like, I mean, how accurate is anything in this world?
So turns out, moral of the story, it's hard to research humans.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I found so interesting about, I bring it up all the time. I don't know why. I'm so proud of my 2 years of psychology or whatever it was.
That's fair.
That was what was so interesting to me about learning about like controlled studies and stuff like that. Because, I mean, really to me, like scientific studies are the only thing that I can like, you know, for sure be like, that must be true because X, Y, and Z, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a controlled study and there's all of these parameters that you have to be like, you know, to be able to publish a peer-reviewed article or whatever. It's like,
yeah,
it's kind of like, okay, this has like
bones. Feels a little bit more rigid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas, you know, other things you can kind of fuck the dog on.
Yeah, exactly. But that's all I have for you.
Well, that was really interesting. Thank you. Yeah,
no problem.
Yeah.
So... that's it.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed this. If you did like this, I mean, I'd be interested to know whether or not you did, so then we can perhaps do this again in the future sometime. I don't know.
Yeah. Like when we have guests on doing like a follow-up episode on questions that came about or what have you.
Yeah. Which, I mean, also would be great because if you guys had questions on guest episodes, then we could also try and research that on your behalf.
So true.
We will become your Google.
Two girls
free of charge. Yeah, exactly.
Whoa. Free of charge. You have to watch the ads fully.
Oh, yeah. No skipping the ads. You have to use at least one promo code a quarter.
Proof of promo code use.
Yeah.
before we start typing into Google. jokes. Okay. Thank you guys so much for watching/listening.
We will see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.